This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. It's been said of life that none of us gets out of here alive. Given that, why is it so hard for so many of us to talk about the end of life? That's one of the big questions in Roz Chast's new memoir about her elderly parents at the end of their lives.
Roz Chast is a cartoonist for The New Yorker who draws and writes about our collective angst, fears, and nightmares, always in a way that is full of wit and wisdom. Her work is hilariously funny, but also poignant and deep.
And that's true of her new memoir, which tells the story through words and drawings about the life and death of her parents who were married for almost 70 years and about her own complicated efforts and emotions as she cared for them. It's called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? Roz Chast is speaking tonight at the Brattle Theater in Cambridge, and she joins us right now in the studio. And Roz Chast, welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
And this book, I have to say, and I was just telling you a moment ago before we went on the air, made me laugh for most of the morning, but also it's deep, and it touched me in a lot of ways. And I think anyone who's dealt with the death of a parent at the end of their life is going to really relate to this. Why did you want to do this story?
I thought it was a very interesting story, and that it had a kind of emotional complexity, and that there were some like really funny things along the way. There were a lot of cartoons that I had done about them before, you know, specifically about things that had happened with them, specific incidents, before I even thought of doing the book. And it all did sort of come together.
Yeah, it seems like in looking at this, it seems like they had a lot to do with the kind of humor that you do in your cartoons. Is that true?
To some extent, they enjoyed a different kind of humor from what I liked. I mean, I can't say our senses of humor did not really overlap. I would say that they liked jokes, you know, like they liked those old-fashioned kind of jokes. A woman goes to the doctor. Punchline, you know. And I don't think they necessarily saw the same things, you know, as funny that I did.
Yeah. Well, let me describe a little bit about them, and I want to get you to describe them. Elizabeth and George Chast, married nearly 70 years, born 10 days apart in the spring of 1912, grew up two blocks apart, attended the same elementary school, and you write, aside from World War II, work, illness, and going to the bathroom, they did everything together.
Oh, absolutely. They were completely entwined with one another. My mother used to say, "The rocks in his head match the holes in mine." I mean, they were a duo.
Yeah, and you portray leaving home as a kind of liberation. You stayed away from your parents' apartment in Brooklyn for many years, but then something drew you back. I mean, as they got older and frailer, you decided to go back, right?
Yeah. Yeah, in some ways, that is the beginning of this book, which was this sort of out-of-the-blue feeling. And I remember the date because it was 2 days before the World Trade Centers were hit. It was very easy to remember, September 9th. It was a Sunday, 2001. And I had this extremely strong feeling that I needed to see them in their natural environment. Hmm. And I hadn't for 10 or 11 years before that.
Why'd you stay away for all those years?
A lot of different reasons. I had moved to Connecticut. I had two young children. I was working. I saw them. They would come up to visit me. They would, at the beginning, my mother drove because my father never learned how to drive. So they would drive up from Brooklyn. Then eventually I just said, I don't want you driving anymore. You have to take car service. We had a lot of fights about that. But then they would come up by car service. So there were certain, I guess, more, you know, on the surface reasons. But also I did not like Brooklyn. I had no desire to go back to that building, to that apartment, to see where I just did not want to.
Hmm. Well, when you did go back, you made an effort to have the conversation, which is where this wonderful memoir begins. And you wanted to talk to them about sort of what they wanted at the end of their lives. And this conversation didn't go well. And this is where the book begins. And I'm wondering if you could read just from the first couple of pages which shows you sitting down with your parents attempting to have the conversation.
Okay. It starts out with me. And I say, so do you guys ever think about things? And my father goes, what kind of things? And I say, you know, things, plans. And my parents are just like mystified. They're looking at each other. And I say, I have no idea what you guys want. Let's say something happened. Am I the only sane person here? And they're like making signs to each other, like, you know, the sort of universal symbol for this person is nuts, where like the person like twirls their finger at their temple, or my father makes the sort of sad violin sort of face. You know what? And then finally I say to them, you know what? Forget it. Never mind. Que sera, sera. And later that same day, I'm back at home and I go, phew. And my father and my mother are back, and they're at home, and they're going, phew, and phew. It's, I mean, part of this was this cartoon, this did not happen exactly like this. This is a sort of compression of many times that I tried to start conversations. Mm-hmm. But I was as complicit in it as they were in avoiding.
In other words, you didn't just really come out and say it.
No, I did not come out and say it.
I need to talk to you about what you want at the end of your life.
No, yeah. No. Right. I mean, we all wanted to avoid it.
Yeah. And then you say on the next page, it was against my parents' principles to talk about death.
Yes.
Why? What principles?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it was like with my mother, especially, I think she believed that if you talked about it, that was as much as saying, come on in. And my father just didn't, you know, he just found it sort of like, you know, he was already a very anxious person, and talking about that made him feel even more anxious. So that was his reason. But no, it was just against, you know, why when you're alive would you want to talk about this horrible thing?
Right.
I wrote, it was against my parents' principles to talk about death, nor would they discuss religion beyond a most superficial level. This is my mother saying to me, I'm a little girl in this panel. I'm Jewish, Daddy is Jewish, you're Jewish, end of story.
That's as far as the religious,
yes.
The religious conversation went.
Yes, and asking too many spiritual, quote-unquote, questions meant that you had too much time on your hands. And my mother's idea, you know, when people would be like, you know, looking for something, you know, spiritual answers, she would go, pure navel-gazing. You know, she just did not respect that.
She didn't. So this wasn't a conversation that was going to gain steam.
No.
But then you're forced in a big way to confront sort of the end with them. At age 93, your mother falls down. Your father couldn't pick her up. And he left the apartment to find a neighbor and somehow got lost in the building. And at that point, even they have to admit that it was time to make some changes. So describe a little bit about what happens next in their life.
At that point, we did... The three of us, I mean, I was at that point going out to see them fairly, somewhat frequently. Once a week, once every 2 weeks, something like that. And they agreed to go to tour the facilities at some place in Brooklyn that a friend of theirs was at. And I went with them. And first of all, they hadn't gone out of the apartment in months. My mother had been in the hospital and she was very weak. And my father didn't go out much either. He would go downstairs to the lobby to check the mail. So this was a big excursion. And I have my own issues with driving, which I'm not going to go into here. But it was like we had this sort of jalopy car service that they used. So getting my parents into their coats, into their outer garments. It was like worse than dressing a toddler. And then having to bring them downstairs and then taking them. By the time we got to this facility, my mother was so exhausted that she looked like she was going to drop dead. And she did sort of like almost pass out on her friend's bed. And then the nurse thought that we were going to have to call the hospital. My mother said no hospital. And then we finally got them back to the apartment, which was another horrible, really frightening ordeal. And it was a little bit after that that I found an assisted living place that was closer to where I lived in Connecticut. And it was just so intense because they'd lived in that apartment. I'm trying to think, that must have been around 2007. And they moved in 1959.
Yeah, so
to that apartment. And they never, you know, it was just almost 50 years. And they packed a little overnight bag, and my mother said, this is just going to be a trial stay. And I think that they knew that they were not going to come back.
Mm.
And they pretty much walked out of the apartment and never saw it again.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
I was struck by so many moments in this memoir. One of them, when you bring your father home to Connecticut while your mother was recovering in the hospital, you write, any Florence Nightingale-type visions I ever had of myself, an unselfish, patient, sweet, caring child who happily tended to her parents in their old age, were destroyed within an hour or so. My father's approaching senility pushed me to my limit. I thought that was incredibly honest, and it must have been difficult of you for you to come to terms with that.
Oh, it's horrible. It's awful. I mean, there's still, you know, I just feel like in so many ways I fell short, you know.
Mm.
I wanted to be a better person. I wanted to be a more patient person. I wanted to be better at it than I was.
Yeah.
But it was really, really hard.
Yeah. And give us an idea why, what was going on with your father by then? I mean, he's falling pretty deeply into sort of moments of dementia.
Yeah. Well, when my mother was in the hospital in Brooklyn for 2 weeks, my father could not be left to stay in the apartment by himself. And we took him back up to Connecticut to live with us. And, I've heard and read a little bit more about this, that sometimes when somebody has senile dementia, when they're in their sort of familiar surroundings and with their beloved, who maybe takes care of them a little bit, many of these symptoms can sort of be masked to a certain extent. But when he came up to Connecticut, he was so disoriented. It was so heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
He would say things like, where do I live? Why am I here? And then the worst was like, where's Elizabeth?
Right. Your mother.
My
right.
mother. My yeah. mother. And I would have to tell him, you know, why she wasn't there. And he would be surprised over and over again. And then he would like, then it would start to, he'd start to remember what had happened. And he'd, you know, say, yes, okay, calm down. You know, how much longer? And, you know, at that point, we weren't really sure. You know, calm down. And then like, a few hours later, it would start up again. It was really very challenging and very, very sad, and sometimes kind of funny. I mean, you know, taking him shopping was really interesting because it had been his clothes were pretty much tatters because they lived deep, deep, deep in Brooklyn. It was not like there were clothing stores around them, and they just had. Their clothes were kind of almost like rags. And, you know, at this point, he's like 94 around, 93, 94. And I took him to, so he hadn't been clothes shopping in a long time. I took him to a place, a big sort of discounty clothing store that has, you know, huge selection of everything, underwear and socks and ties and, he hadn't seen the new types of underwear ads ever.
Mm.
And so in the men's department is this big 3x4 photo of a man wearing briefs and no shirt. And he has a hairless chest. And my father just does this double take. And he goes, "What? I don't understand that." And I said, "What, Dad?" And he goes, "It looks like that man has breasts." And it was because, you know, the guy had the giant pecs.
Right.
And this was just so foreign to him. You know, the waxed chest with the pecs and probably the shirtlessness itself, you know.
Yeah.
It was something.
You know, given this experience and watching your parents decline, you came away with some pretty strong views about the push for not immortality, but the push and the desire to live extended lives, to live until you're 110 or 114. Not such a good idea.
Well, I think that if I had not gone through this experience, I might have thought, huh, let's look into that. But, I mean, aside from the economic complications of that, my guess is that between 98 and 114, those are not going to be great years. You might, I mean, people can live a long time if nothing goes hideously wrong, but the way that the quality of life is so compromised. I mean, but I don't know, because I'm saying this from my perspective, and maybe when you are 98, if you're lying in a bed and you're totally incontinent and you are not getting out of that bed and you don't eat anymore, you just drink Ensure, maybe that's fine.
Well, you know, it's funny.
I don't know.
I had an experience with my grandmother. She lived into her early 90s, and we were involved very deeply with her life toward the end. And I remember going to her one morning and saying, "How are you doing today?" And she still had these blazing eyes and a mind as sharp as a tack. And she said, "Dear boy, how do you think I'm doing? I can't taste anything. I can barely see anything anymore. Everyone I know is dead. What do you mean, how am I doing?" I mean, it was sort of something, and it kind of opened my eyes in that moment. At first, I felt like that's not a very nice way to answer a perfectly friendly question, but of course, upon further reflection, she had every right to say that and feel that way.
I mean, did you read Roger Angel's piece in The New Yorker about 2 months ago?
I did not.
Oh, it was just fantastic.
Well, I will look for it.
Yeah,
about
this about aging and about being, you know, when all of your spouse is gone, your friends are gone. Mm. And by gone, I don't mean like they're off on vacation. I mean, they're dead. They're gone. And you are the only one left. I mean, it might be kind of lonely. I don't know.
I have our time is running short. Have you had the conversation with your children?
I have not. Hmm. It's a hard conversation to have, and I guess I don't feel like it's quite necessary yet, but I probably should.
Mm. On the other hand, you might be tempted to say, can't we talk about something more pleasant?
Yeah, and then my kids will go,
Well, Roz Chast, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for this book. I really recommend it. It's funny, poignant, powerful. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in. That's Roz Chast. She's an illustrator and cartoonist whose work has appeared in The New Yorker since 1978. Her new memoir is called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And she'll be speaking tonight at the Brattle Theater. A lot more information at radioboston.org. Stay with us, because coming up, Adam Begley has a new autobiography of John Updike. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.